This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, Internet. Welcome to the Season 13 finale of Quiz and Hers, the trivia podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. This is our 13th 10-week battle for glory, in fact.
Yep.
If you're new to the podcast, here's what we do. Each week, one of us writes 6 trivia questions to ask the other person.
Would you like to introduce us?
Nah.
Okay.
All right, I guess so.
Okay.
All right, my name's Justin. I'll be your host today. I'm here with my wife, who will be your quiz mistress for the evening, or morning, or whenever you're listening to this.
Hello.
You got distracted, and what were you doing?
I'm so sorry, I was fact-checking something.
Okay, so right up to the 11th hour, fact-checking. All right, anyway.
Yep.
Probably should have been done before we sat down and started
recording. I just had a thought.
All right. Anyway, that's Hallie, your woefully underprepared quiz mistress for the week.
Hello, that's me. That's my podcast,
persona?
Persona, yes.
Yeah.
Not my real life persona, I'm very prepared.
Yeah, all right. So, each week, one of us, in this case Hallie, writes 6 questions to ask the other person. One from each of our 6 categories, which are arts and literature, times and places, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. After each question, she'll talk about the answer for a few minutes to teach us all a little more about that subject. And all 6 questions are always related to some common theme that sort of defines the focus of the game. So, this is the last episode of the season. Hallie, you are currently leading this season 16 correct answers to 15.
Blah.
Which means...
not enough.
...that I need to get one answer correct today to
yep.
force a tiebreaker next week, which I really don't feel like doing, so hopefully I just get at least 2 correct and I just win the season outright.
We shall see.
We shall see. All right. What's the theme for today's game, Quiz Mistress?
All right. Today's theme is where in Quiz and Hers is Carmen, not San Diego.
I'm sorry, what?
It's about Carmen's, not San Diego. Not of the San Diego variety.
Carmen's non-San Diego?
Correct.
I just did this season. I had an Odyssey of Homers a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you did. That is true. I'm sorry. I started in a different direction and we ended up with a game about Carmen's. I don't know.
How does that happen?
Shit
by
happens.
Accident?
Don't worry about it.
All right.
Sometimes you just end up in a weird place. Does it really matter?
No, but I am curious.
I don't know. I think I started out wanting to do something about Carmen Sandiego, but it just didn't quite work. It all started with the title, which is very rare.
Okay.
Usually I start with like one thing. You know?
Right. Yeah. All right.
But anyway, here we are.
Okay.
So, question one is music. Probably the main Carmen you think of when you think of Carmen.
Bizet.
All right. The opera Carmen.
Bizet.
The opera Carmen is based on an 1845 novella by what French writer, a pioneer of the novella, who also wrote La Venus d'Ile and Columba?
Wait, really?
Really? Why?
I had no idea it was based on anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's
an
opera.
It was based on a novella, and the guy who wrote the novella, whose name you have to tell me, actually was the pioneer, like one of the first people to do the novella genre.
I don't know. I mean, every opera is based on something, isn't it? But I had no idea what Carmen was based on, and I don't know who wrote the novella. So, you said French. I will guess Dumas, maybe?
No.
Ugh.
It's Prosper Mérimée.
Yeah, no one has ever said those combination of syllables together, ever.
He was a pioneer of the novella, and he was known for other things, and he had a decently sized Wikipedia article. But
and
anyway,
you're not going to talk about it. You're going to talk about Carmen.
Yeah, because I had to make this somewhat difficult. I can't just have you getting everything. It would not be interesting.
All right.
Carmen is an opera composed, as you said, by Georges Bizet. The libretto was written by Ludovic Halévy and Henri Mélac, based on the novella, like I said, by Prosper Mérimée. In 1872, Bizet's opera Jamila opened at the Opéra Comique in Paris. Although it didn't do well and was withdrawn after just 11 performances, they commissioned him to write another opera for them, with Halévy and Mélac writing the libretto. Bizet proposed the idea of adapting Mérimée's novella. The opera takes place in Seville, Spain. In Act 1, there is a crowd of soldiers. Carmen, also called a gypsy girl, because that's what she's considered,
even though that is now considered to be a racial slur.
Correct, yes. But that's the opera.
Yes.
She sings her habanera. Is it habanera or habanera?
I think habanera.
It's habanera, because it's not like a Spanish. Well, it is Spanish, but it's habanera.
Right, yeah.
And it's about the untamable nature of love. And that's probably one of the most famous opera songs ever. And I will hum it for you. Or not hum, but I will doot it for you. Doot, 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 doot. Doot, 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 doot. That's all you get.
That's the one.
I don't know if dooting is a thing, but I just made it up. It's easier than humming.
Carmen is really good. Like, I'm not big into opera, but...
It's really good.
I really like the Carmen suites that Bizet composed, which are the orchestral scoring of the opera. So there's no operatic singing, which I guess some people are into, but I prefer just instrumental music.
Yeah.
It's really good. It's a really fucking good piece of music.
Yeah. Anyway, all the soldiers love her, but she throws a flower to Jose, the only one who is ignoring her, because playing hard to get is how you do it.
I guess.
He wasn't playing hard to get. He just was ignoring her. Then another character, Michaela, brings Jose a letter from his mother saying that he should marry her, not Carmen, Michaela. And he's about to tell her that he's cool with that, but then there's a stampede of women coming out of the factory, and they learn that Carmen has stabbed another woman. So there's a whole thing happening all of a sudden. Jose has to tie her hands so that Zuniga, the lieutenant, can arrest her. While Jose is alone with Carmen, she sings him a seguidilla, an old Castilian folk song, and he is so entranced that he agrees to untie her. He then gets arrested for negligence on the job. Fair enough.
Yeah, rightly so.
Yeah. In Act 2, it is 2 months later, and Carmen learns of Jose's release from jail. Escamillo, the toreador, sets his sights on Carmen, but she ignores him. Jose arrives and Carmen gives him a private dance. A private dance.
Giggity.
Yep. He goes to leave for work and Carmen mocks him, but then he shows her that he still has the flowers she gave him. Very sweet. Carmen asks him to run away with her, but then his boss shows up and he and Jose fight. Since Jose attacked a superior officer, he has no choice but to join Carmen and the smugglers. So basically he leaves his job so he doesn't get in trouble.
He becomes an outlaw.
Yeah. By Act 3, Carmen has become bored of Jose and tells him to go back to his mother. Ouch.
Brutal.
Escamillo, the toreador, shows up, and he and Jose fight over Carmen. Michaela also shows up and wants Jose to leave with her, but he refuses. However, she tells him that his mother is dying, so he agrees to go. Act 4 takes place at Escamillo's bullfight. Escamillo and Carmen declare their love for each other. Then Jose confronts her and begs her to return to him, but she refuses and throws the ring that he gave her. She tries to enter the arena, but Jose stabs her, and as the bullfight is starting, Carmen dies.
Right.
Brutal.
My first introduction to Carmen was that episode of Hey Arnold.
I don't remember that.
There was an episode of Hey Arnold that was... I think the conceit of it was they were going on a field trip to see Carmen, at the opera, but it just... The episode is mostly just... the plot of Carmen with kid-friendly lyrics sung by the characters of that show.
Interesting.
It's actually pretty good.
I wonder where you can watch Hey Arnold these days.
YouTube, probably.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Is it Helga? Is Helga Carmen?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, cool.
And, the weird kid who I don't think even really has a name is Escamillo. That other weird kid who's into Helga.
Okay. Anyway. I don't remember.
Anyway, it's pretty good.
Cool. The premiere of Carmen was delayed because rehearsals took longer than anticipated. It finally premiered on March 3rd, 1875. Apparently, the audience's reaction was good at first, but by the end, no one seemed to be enjoying it. It was believed that they were shocked by the realism of all the action and the depravity of the characters. The reviews were also negative. In its initial run at the Opera Comique, it was often performed to half-empty houses. The day after the opera's 33rd performance, Bizet died suddenly at the age of 36 from heart disease, which I did not know.
Oh, wow. I didn't either.
That night, the performance was canceled, but afterwards, the news increased the public's interest in the opera. It had another run in November 1875. Tchaikovsky saw it and wrote, quote, "Carmen is a masterpiece in every sense of the word." I agree.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. Soon after, it began to have other runs throughout Europe. In 1884, it was first performed at the New York Metropolitan Opera. Since then, it has been performed there almost 1,000 times.
Wow.
In 1943, Oscar Hammerstein created a musical called Carmen Jones based on the opera and featuring an all-black cast. It was then made into a film directed by Otto Preminger. Did I say that right? Preminger?
Not sure.
In 1954. Whatever. In 2001, Beyoncé starred in an adaptation called Carmen, a hip-hopera.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that.
I listened to a bit. It's hip-hop.
Right.
That's all. Okay. Question two is times and places.
All right.
Carmen Cass is a model who also ran for the European Parliament after her homeland joined the European Union in 2004. Name this country bordered to the north by the Gulf of Finland and to the west by the Baltic Sea. Also, I'm very proud of myself because I had a different question structure.
Yeah, you did it the quiz bowl style.
A rare occasion.
Yeah.
I've been reading too many quiz bowl questions.
Yeah. You said bordered to the...
Bordered to the north by the Gulf of Finland and to the west by the Baltic Sea.
Okay. It's got to be Sweden, because Norway is bordered to the west by Sweden. Wait, no, east. Hang on. It's bordered on the west by the Baltic Sea and the north by the Gulf of Finland. Okay. All right. So it's not Sweden then. I suppose then it would be the northernmost of the Baltic states, which would be Estonia.
Your guess?
Yes, I'll say it's Estonia.
It is Estonia.
Yes, okay.
Good job.
I had to puzzle that. I confused my east and my west there for a second, and it almost cost me a right answer.
Yep, well, now we're tied.
Sweet.
The Republic of Estonia is a country in Northern Europe. Like I said, it is bordered on the north by the Gulf of Finland and on the west by the Baltic Sea. It is also bordered on the east by Russia and on the south by Latvia.
Which is in turn bordered on the south by Lithuania, the other of the three Baltic states, and you can remember that because they're alphabetical from north to south.
That is true.
That's how I remember it.
In addition to the mainland, Estonia also has 2,222 islands in the Baltic Sea.
That's too many islands.
But it's great because it's 2222. Not that this would come up in trivia, I just like that number.
It's 2222 many.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Nailed it.
Okay.
Swish.
All right. The capital is Tallinn and the other largest city is Tartu. The official language of Estonia is Estonian, which is the second most spoken Finnic language after Finnish, obviously.
Right. Yes, makes sense.
So we're going to talk about Estonian history.
All right.
In the early 7th century, Estonian Vikings killed Swedish King Ingvar. Then, in 1030, Yaroslav the Wise of Russia defeated the Estonians and established a fort in what is now Tartu. But in 1061, an Estonian tribe called the Sosols destroyed his empire. Around that time, Estonia had two cultural areas. In the northern and western parts, people had more contact with Scandinavians and Finland, whereas in the southern and eastern parts, they had more contact with Balts and Pskov. Don't worry about it.
Pskov?
Yeah, it's like an area over there.
Okay.
In 1199, Pope Innocent III declared a crusade to, quote, defend the Christians of Livonia, which was the Baltic coast of Latvia. That's what Livonia was.
Okay.
In 1217, the Estonians suffered a defeat at the Battle of St. Matthew's Day, and in 1219, Danish King Valdemar II defeated the Estonians at the Battle of Lindanis. In the 16th century, the Reformation spread to Estonia. In 1558, Ivan the Terrible invaded Estonia, which started the Livonian War. In 1560, the Livonian Order was defeated, and most of Estonia accepted Polish rule, whereas the nobles of northern Estonia swore loyalty to the Swedish king.
So would the term Estonia have even been, like, in use at this point, or are we just sort of talking about, like, that area now?
It's just where it is now.
Right, okay. But it would not have been considered, like, a meaningful thing to say. Like, at this time...
No.
We've talked about this before. Like, Italy didn't exist in a political sense at this time, but it still meant something kind of, like, cultural
right.
and geographic. But Estonia wasn't even that. It didn't mean... It was just nothing at this point.
Right.
Okay, all right. That makes sense.
In the Polish-Swedish War, Sweden gained Livonia. Then, in 1700, the Great Northern War started, in which the Russian Empire conquered all of Estonia.
I've actually heard of that one. Not
cool.
Sure why.
I don't know. In the 1850s, the Estonian National Awakening began, and the first nationwide movement started. So that's when Estonian became a thing.
When
really.
It became like a national identity.
Yeah.
Nationalism engenders nations, not the other way around.
Okay, thanks.
It's a famous quote. I forget who it's from, but I think it's definitely true.
Yeah. But later in the 19th century, the government began trying to make them more a part of the Russian Empire. They began using the Russian language for education purposes and tried to suppress Estonian cultural activities. During the Russian Revolution of 1905, Estonian political parties were founded. The Tsarist government responded by executing about 500 people and sending hundreds more to jail or Siberia.
As the Russian Tsars typically did.
Yes.
Yep.
Then in 1917, after the February Revolution, Estonia was granted autonomy. They declared independence of Estonia in 1918, but German occupation immediately followed, so it didn't last very long.
As Germany often did in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of 1918, Soviet Russia invaded, which started the Estonian War of Independence.
As Soviet Russia did. There's a lot of very recurring historical themes happening here.
In February 1920, the Tartu Peace Treaty was signed between Estonia and Soviet Russia. In 1921, Estonia joined the League of Nations. They signed non-aggression pacts with the Soviet Union in 1932 and with Germany in 1939. I guess you know what's coming. In 1940, yeah. The Soviet Union forced Estonia to let them in, and in August, Estonia was annexed by the Soviet Union.
It's funny how non-aggression pacts with the USSR and Nazi Germany never seemed to work.
Yeah. In 1941, they deported 11,000 people to Siberia. They also drafted 34,000 Estonian men into the Red Army, of which less than a third survived World War II.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
There were also thousands of Estonians who escaped to Finland to fight with them against the Soviets.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. After World War II, a guerrilla movement called Forest Brothers was started to oppose the second Soviet occupation, but the resistance pretty much stopped by the mid-50s.
So it was politically part of, like, Russia. Like, it wasn't a different Soviet republic within the USSR. It was just, like, controlled militarily by the USSR. Like, was it part of the Russian SSR, or was it its own Estonian SSR?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Do you want to look it up?
No, not really. I was just curious. It's not the type of thing that would come up in trivia. I was just wondering if it was, like...
I'm not sure.
Okay, because, you know, the Soviet Union...
It wasn't clear from what I was reading.
Okay, because, you know, the Soviet Union was made up of, like, a dozen or so nominally independent Soviet socialist republics. Now, of course, realistically, they were all basically under the thumb of...
Right.
...Russia.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Interesting. Okay, I don't know. I was just curious.
In 1988, new political movements started, like the Popular Front of Estonia, which was more moderate, and the Estonian National Independence Party, which was more radical. In 1990, the Congress of Estonia was formed, and on August 20th, 1991, they declared independence. In 2004, Estonia joined the European Union and NATO. The current president is Kersti Kaljulaid, which is a man, and the prime minister is Kaja Kallas, who is a woman.
Okay.
I just wanted to distinguish that, if you were wondering.
I mean, I would not have known that, because neither of those names is a name that I've ever heard, so.
Yeah, Finnic languages are difficult.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah. Okay, are you ready for question three?
I'm ready.
It is sports and games.
Okay. Weirdly, sports and games, by the way, the category we have done the best at so far this season, I'm pretty sure.
Our questions are probably easier because we don't know as much about it.
Oh, it's tied with everything else. There have been 6 correct answers in sports and games and 6 correct answers in everything else so far this season.
Interesting.
If you were wondering.
I wasn't, but now I'm interested.
All right. I keep these stats because I'm a stats nerd, so.
Yep.
All right. Go for it.
In 2013, Carmen Martin became Australia's first world champion in what Korean martial art, which emphasizes punching and kicking techniques?
Korean martial art. Okay, so it's not judo. That's Japanese and also is mainly about throws. Also, I talked about Ronda Rousey. I didn't talk about judo specifically, I guess, but it's not judo. Karate would be Japanese, although there are forms of karate in other countries. Probably not jujitsu. I think that's Japanese as well. Definitely not kung fu. Have I heard of this? Like, is there any chance I'm going to get this, or is this just one of your bullshit questions I'm not supposed to get?
You do not get that information.
All right, then I'm just going to keep trying to talk it out. You could cut off my filibuster if you just told me there's no chance in hell I'm going to get it, but...
I mean, I'm going to tell you, you're probably going to get something else right, so, like, chill out.
Yes, but I like getting questions right.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
All right, I'm going to guess, and this is wrong, but I'm going to guess the specific... South Korean variety of karate that I took as a child for about a year, which was called Tangsudo.
No.
I know.
But you're, like, close, I guess. It's Taekwondo.
Oh, that's Korean, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It is. So I'll tell you about the history. It began in 1945 when new martial arts schools called Kwans opened in Seoul. They were run by Korean martial artists who mainly practiced Japanese and Chinese martial arts. At the time, each Kwan had its own fighting style. At first, there was Korean karate, which they called Tangsudo, which you just talked about.
Very briefly, yep. I was not very good at it, and I didn't do it for very long.
You were on the right track. I took one Taekwondo class in college, and in hindsight, I have no idea why. I don't remember why we did that.
Gym requirement?
No, we like went for fun.
What?
Oh, yeah. I think we went because it was like a free gym class. Not for us.
Okay.
They then took that and changed it slightly to Taesudo to describe a unified Korean martial arts. Choi Hong-hee, a Korean army general, advocated changing the name to Taekwondo, replacing Su, which means hand, to Kwan, which means fist. Taekwondo was also adopted by the South Korean military. In 1959, they established the Korea Taekwondo Association to help unify Korean martial arts. General Choi wanted the Kwans to adopt his style of Taekwondo, and he ended up starting his own group in 1966 called the International Taekwondo Federation. He then
So Kwan means fist and also school? Is that right?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Kwan, K-W-A-N, are the schools, and Kwan, K-W-O-N, is fist.
Oh, okay, so I thought
That was confusing in hindsight, sorry.
I thought you were saying that, like, it was going to be... where I thought it was going was that it was going to be... Taekwondo was going to end up meaning, like, something-something Korean school of martial arts.
This is one of those things that does not translate well in podcast form, because I'm reading it, and I'm like, this is very clear, but you're right.
Okay, so... K-W-A-N is like a martial arts school. K-W-O-N is a closed fist.
Correct.
Cool. Okay.
Anyway, Choi devoted himself to institutionalizing his own style of Taekwondo in Canada for some reason. In 1972, South Korea withdrew its support for ITF because Choi was trying to get support from everyone, including North Korea, and they didn't want to be associated with that.
Ooh, bad move.
He was power hungry. Taekwondo power. I don't know.
He was recognition hungry, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Taekwondo was included in the Olympics for the first time in 2000.
I remember that, kinda.
It is one of three martial arts in the Olympics, the others being judo and karate.
Right, yes.
Most forms of Taekwondo base their philosophy on the five commandments of the Hwarang.
I'm gonna push back on that a little bit. You could consider wrestling to be a martial art of sorts.
Okay, sure.
But
Asian martial arts?
Fair enough, okay. What you imagine when you imagine martial arts, but you could argue that wrestling... I'm just being a dick.
The Hwarang were an elite warrior group in ancient Korea. The five tenets of Taekwondo created by Choi were courtesy, integrity, perseverance, self-control, and indomitable spirit. Taekwondo focuses on head-height kicks, jumping and spinning kicks, and fast-kicking techniques. Choi created the relaxed strike principle of Taekwondo, which says that between kicks, blocks, and strikes, the person should relax their body. This supposedly increases the power of the technique by conserving energy.
Seems plausible, I guess.
Yeah. This also includes the sine wave technique, it's called, in which a person raises their center of gravity between moves and lowers it during moves, so they're moving up and down. And the sine wave technique is only done in ITF-style Taekwondo. Competition usually involves sparring, breaking, and patterns. So, like, sparring is what you normally see, breaking is, like, breaking shit, and patterns is, like, moves.
Right, like forms in karate. Like kata, they're called in karate, I think.
Okay.
Just practicing maneuvers, basically, yeah.
Olympic Taekwondo is only sparring. In Olympic Taekwondo and World Taekwondo, or WT, there is a continuous scoring system, and fighters are allowed to continue after scoring each technique. One can win based on points or by a knockout if one player can't continue.
Right.
Each match is 3 2-minute rounds with 1 minute of rest between rounds. In tournaments, players wear an electronic hogis, or armor, as well as electronic socks and, or actually it's not hogis, it's hogus.
Okay, yep, that makes more sense.
As well as electronic socks and head protectors. The electronic scoring system assesses the strength and location of the contact.
Oh, so it's like, sort of like fencing. Yeah. It detects where you have hit and how hard. Oh, that's interesting.
A punch on the hogu is 1 point. A kick to the hogu is 2 points. A kick to the head is 3 points. And a technical kick involving turning or spinning is 4 points if it's on the hogu and 5 points if it's on the head.
Okay.
So the fancier, the better.
Right, yeah, so you get style points, basically, in Taekwondo.
Yes.
Okay,
and cool. The person with the most points after the three rounds wins, like I said.
Right, or if you just put your opponent on their ass and they can't continue, you win automatically.
Right.
Which makes sense.
Taekwondo ranks differ among the different styles of Taekwondo. The junior ranks, aka the color belts, are called gup in Korean. Gup. Usually the lowest rank is white and the highest junior rank is red or brown.
Okay.
There are usually between 8 and 12 gup ranks. The highest rank is called first gup, and basically it goes, you know what I'm saying? The highest one is first, you go from
lower like ones are higher numbers.
8 to first.
Right, yeah.
And then the senior ranks, aka the black belts, usually have 9 ranks. Each rank is called a dan or degree. The numbering for senior ranks is the opposite of the junior ranks, so first dan is the lowest black belt.
Right,
rank.
So a ninth degree black belt is just an invincible monster.
Right.
Right. I was just reading about this. I should have thought of this.
Oh, that's funny.
Because I was reading an old Food and Wine magazine we had laying around, and there was an article about a chef who, like, lost a bunch of weight by training in Taekwondo, and he's a second degree black belt, like, 7 years into his training. And
that's cool.
Fucking hell, how did I not think of this?
Oh, well.
I could have just won the season. Ugh.
That's okay. You have time. Some styles of Taekwondo have a rank in between junior and senior ranks called Bodan, which is basically the rank who are candidates to become black belts. In the recent Tokyo Olympics, the Russian Olympic Committee got the most medals in Taekwondo with 4. Great Britain and South Korea each earned 3. Croatia, Serbia, Egypt, and Turkey each got 2. And then there were a bunch who got 1, including the U.S. and China. And I'm going to be a little U.S.-centric here. The winner for the U.S., Anastasia Zolotik, was the first women's Taekwondo champion from the United States.
I remember reading that.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So that brings us to halftime. We are currently tied 16-16 on the season. I still need another answer unless we want to end up doing a tiebreaker next week, which I don't feel like doing, so I'd rather just win.
You have 3 chances. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, so we're going to take a break now from the game. First of all, to thank all of you for listening. We really do appreciate you spending a little time with us and trying to learn something new. If you would like to contact us, you could do so by emailing us. We are quizandhers@gmail.com if you want to communicate with us. Or you can follow and interact with us on social media. We are @quizandhers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And of course, make sure that in whatever app you're listening to this in, you hit that like and subscribe and rate and review button. That really does help us out if you want to give us some extra exposure or just, you know, maybe tell a friend that you think would like this, one of your pub trivia friends or whatever, someone you think would enjoy the show. That's really the best way to help us grow the audience. And as we always say, of course, we are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. You can check them out on bigheadsmedia.com. While you're there, you can buy Quiz and Hers branded merchandise if you so desire. There are t-shirts, hoodies, coffee mugs, trucker hats, whatever, with our logo on it, if you would like to do that. And while you're there, make sure to check out some of the other great podcasts on the network, one of which we will introduce you to right now.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I'm one of the hosts of Massive Late Fee. Do you remember Blockbuster? Well, we do, and we racked up a lot of late fees there. That's why we're glad there's things like Netflix, Hulu, and Blockbuster has died, mostly because of us. We cover streaming shows and pretty much whatever we want. Join us every Thursday as we talk TV and movies on Massive Late Fee. You can find us at Massive Late Fee on Twitter, Massive Late Fee on Facebook. You can email the show at MassiveLateFee@gmail.com, and you can find us at MySpace, Massive Late Fee. Massive Late Fee, the best podcast we can think of.
All right. So, that's the ad. Hallie, back to you. I really need to get one of these right.
Yes, you do.
Okay.
Well, you have 3 chances.
All right.
All right. Question 4 is arts and literature. In what 1955 novel is the title character really named Dolores, although the unreliable narrator sometimes also calls her Carmen?
Yes. So, the unreliable narrator is Humbert Humbert. The author is Vladimir Nabokov. And the title character is Dolores Hayes, also known as Lolita.
Correct. You win.
Champ, baby. Yes.
Okay.
First 7-time champion.
Oh my God. You're such a pain about this. 7-time champ. Okay. Lolita, like you said, is written by Nabokov.
Yeah.
It's written from the perspective of an unreliable narrator. You told me. His name which is Humbert. Well, it's not his name, but it's what he calls himself.
Humbert.
It's not really his name.
Not only is he an unreliable narrator, he's also a pedophile and one of the least likable characters in the history of literature.
Correct.
Yeah, he's horrible.
He is a middle-aged literature professor who becomes obsessed with a 12-year-old girl named Dolores Hayes. The novel has a foreword, which is part of the story, in which a man says that Humbert Humbert recently died in jail while awaiting a murder trial. The novel then goes back to Humbert's birth and his childhood, which I won't really get into. Later in life, he moves to New England, where the house he was planning to live in burns down.
Something like his sister was his first victim or something, right?
No, there was some girl. I think her name was like Annabelle or something.
Right. It's not his sister, but there's some. Yes.
He's always been. He calls these girls nymphettes. That's
which
like
is
his
so
thing.
Gross. Yeah. But yeah, right. He's fixated on this girl from his childhood, right? Like that's why he's such a fucking creep.
Yes. Anyway, while looking for a place to stay, he meets Charlotte Hayes. She offers him a place to stay, and he intends to decline, but then sees her daughter, Dolores, and decides to move in, because he's insane.
Ugh, it's so gross.
During the summer, while Dolores is away at camp, Charlotte confesses her love for him and says that he has to marry her or move out immediately. That's some ultimatum. He agrees so that he can stay close to Dolores. Blah. One day, Charlotte finds Humbert's diary, in which he talked about his love for Dolores and his disgust of Charlotte. She decides to leave with Dolores, but not before writing letters to everyone to warn them about Humbert.
Right, that he's a fucking pedophile.
Correct. As she is going to mail the letters, she is hit by a car and dies. Humbert destroys the letters and picks Dolores up from camp. He then takes her to a hotel where he gives her a sedative. Real great.
Oh, is that how it goes down? Oh, God.
At the hotel, he meets a mysterious man who seems to know what he's up to. The sedative doesn't really work as well as he thought, so she keeps waking up. Then he doesn't touch her, and she also tells him that she already lost her virginity to an older boy at camp, which is gross because I'm pretty sure she's still got to be like 12 or 13.
Yeah, she's very young at this point.
Too young.
Right. So, yes, this is where the term Lolita for like an inappropriately sexually precocious young child comes from.
I never heard that term for that, but okay.
Well, yeah, because there is a reading of this book where she's the one who seduces him. Now, that's obviously, like, problematic in many ways.
Yeah, even if she did seduce him, fuck that.
Right, 13-year-olds cannot
legally... You're an adult man.
Cannot legally consent to sex with adults, right? So, like, yeah, there are obvious...
Their brains are not fully developed.
Right, they're... Well, neither are 20-year-olds, but yes, legally and ethically, there are serious issues with that interpretation, but that is sometimes how the term Lolita is used. Real fucked weird.
Okay, so anyway, after that, Humbert begins to sexually abuse her, obviously.
Yeah, this is a book about raping a child.
It's bad. Anyway, the two of them travel together, staying in motels. He bribes her in exchange for sexual favors, and they settle in another New England town where he poses as her father and enrolls her in school. This is disgusting.
Yeah.
Dolores is supposed to be in a play, but before the performance, she and Humbert have a fight, and she tells him that she wants to leave. He realizes that there is a man following them after they leave. He finds out that the man's name is Claire Quilty, and he was a friend of Charlotte's. Soon after, Dolores falls ill, and she is taken from the hospital by somebody. He doesn't know who.
Dun dun dun.
He searches for her, but he fails, and he never finds her. He then starts a relationship with a young alcoholic named Rita, who is, I assume, is not 12.
The fuck? I mean, maybe.
No, she's an alcoholic.
There are, yeah.
She's not.
This is a book about the absolute worst elements of society.
She's young,
so...
but I don't think she's that young.
All right.
2 years later, he receives a letter from 17-year-old Dolores telling him that she is married, pregnant, and in need of money. He tracks her down and goes to bring her the money. She tells him that Quilty had abducted her from the hospital and that she was actually in love with him, but he rejected her after she refused to star in his pornographic film. What is wrong with these people?
Right. So Quilty is the only character in this book worse than Humbert Humbert in that he is not only a child rapist, he is also a child pornographer.
Right. And that he rejected her. I don't even know. It's super messed up.
Well, that's what's interesting about the character of Lolita is that's how she reads what's happening to her. Right.
Right.
That, like, she thinks it's her fault.
Right.
That he rejected her when in reality what happened was she said, I don't want to be in child porn.
Yeah.
And he threw her out on the street.
Jesus. Okay.
Awful.
Yeah. Afterwards, Humbert goes to Quilty's mansion and shoots him. He gets arrested and asks that his memoir not to be released until after her death, because obviously he doesn't want her whole life to be messed up.
Right, yeah, he doesn't want her to become an object of fascination.
Right.
To anyone but him.
Sure. Unfortunately, she dies before he does, when she dies in childbirth.
Yeah, childbirth, right.
Obviously, this book was and is super controversial. It was also pretty hard to get published, obviously.
Yeah.
When it finally was, it was banned in the UK and France. In the US, it became the first book since Gone with the Wind to sell 100,000 copies in its first 3 weeks, which I don't know what says about us as a country, but there you go.
Yeah.
Probably just fascination. People were curious.
And yeah, I mean, there's two interpretations of that. One is that people wanted it because for like titillation purposes, but that's not really my understanding. I've not read the book, but I had a friend in high school who read it out of like mostly morbid curiosity. And the way that she always described it to me was it's not a sexy book in any sense. Like, it is just unpleasant.
Nabokov was not like on board with this or anything.
Oh, no. Like, Nabokov said in interviews that like Humbert is the worst character he ever wrote.
I don't know. I think he just had the idea and was like, I just have to do it.
I think he found it to be an interesting character study of a terrible, terrible person.
But I mean, it is. Like, how many TV shows and books and movies do we like that are about horrible people? I mean, it's fascinating.
Law & Order SVU has been on for 23 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And I enjoy that show.
People are interested. I don't know.
Yeah, so the other reading of that, the other interpretation, and I think probably the right one, is that America has an appetite for characters that they can hate.
Yeah.
Right, they can,
and it's also like the true crime thing. Like, it's,
exactly,
it's fascinating and it's gross. I don't know.
Right, it's interesting and intellectually pleasurable in its uncomfortableness.
I'm trying to think of like a TV show that I've watched about a character that I hate. Because I was thinking about Dexter.
Dexter, you should hate him.
I don't.
He's a serial killer.
Yes, but the whole point of Dexter is that they try to make him be, what's the word?
He's a monster, but he's less of a monster than the people he goes up against.
What's the word, like, not lovable, but, like, relatable?
No.
Not relatable.
He's not relatable at all. He's a psychopath.
I don't know what the word is. The word is, like, they do a good job of making him likable.
So, I think the reason we like Dexter is because every season, and I'm thinking of the first and fourth seasons especially, I like the show a lot.
But also, he has a kid, and he's so good to the kid, and it's like, that's...
Okay, as I was saying before you interrupted me.
Sorry.
He is a terrible, terrible person, but the person that he is hunting is basically the devil. And right. So, like, he is far and away the lesser of two evils in every season, and right, that's what makes you root for him, because you really, really want the other person to get what they deserve.
Right, but that's also, like, his whole thing, so you have to, like, respect the fact that he's not just going out there and killing good people, or even just whoever. It's, like, purposeful, so, like, it's hard to... I don't know.
I mean, we could debate this for hours, because he is not killing bad people out of the goodness of his heart, and not because he wants the world to be better. Well, it could. You know, he's not killing serial killers because he wants to improve the world and stop them from killing. He's just that's his code, is that he only kills other killers.
Yeah, but you're just being deontological. Okay, moving on.
I'm being intention focused.
Okay, whatever.
Which there is space for intention in utilitarianism as well.
Okay, fine.
It's a slightly complicated exegesis.
And now that we've lost the entire listener base of this podcast.
Right, yes. So my expertise as a psychologist is moral judgment. I spend a lot of time thinking about
Do a discussion on this? Because we should. Okay. I love this.
All right.
The Good Place. Maybe I'll talk about The Good Place and I'll just tie it all in.
I hate that show. Anyway, this is what we talk about when we're not on mic.
Also, the new season of Dexter is coming out November 7th, and we're going to have to watch all of it before that, even though Justin doesn't want to. I don't care.
Well, because the last four seasons aren't very good.
Two.
No.
Yes.
No, season six was the religious one. That was bad. Season five was the one with Julia Stiles. It was okay.
I liked it. Okay.
It was okay.
Whatever. I love that show. All right, okay.
Moving on. Lolita, child rape. Continue.
Lolita. Oh, there was just one more thing.
Okay.
Just that there have been many adaptations, including plays and musicals, which I find very strange.
And a couple of movies, I think, as well, right?
Yeah, movies. But I just thought musicals should be mentioned, because that's crazy to me. Doesn't seem like it would translate.
It's hard to imagine a jaunty Broadway musical wherein the element. But most Broadway musicals are jaunty.
Dear Evan Hansen's about suicide.
Yeah, and it's not very good, but...
I mean, you don't even know that. Do you know a single song from that?
No, I saw the trailer today when we went to the movies. It looked terrible.
Well, that's only because Ben Platt looks like a 40-year-old. Okay, whatever.
Anyway, it is hard to imagine a jaunty Broadway musical about raping a 12-year-old.
I'm sure it's not jaunty. I don't know. I don't want to know.
No, I have no interest in that.
Okay, question 5.
But the book is considered a classic of literature, so...
Yes, good to know. Question 5. Movies and TV. Carmen Electra's breakthrough acting role was as Lonnie McKenzie in what action drama TV show, which began in 1989 and moved settings in 1999 from LA to Hawaii?
I thought she was from Baywatch, but those dates don't seem right to me, but I don't have a better guess. And I already won, so it doesn't matter. So Baywatch?
Yes.
Oh, wait, Baywatch was 89 to 99?
Yeah.
That show was on television when I was 11 years old. Huh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Okay.
Seems like...
I feel like you have some regret.
A little bit.
You missed it.
That's... Yeah. I feel like my...
I wonder if you could watch that. Not that I ever would.
I think my 11-year-old self would have enjoyed certain aspects of that show.
Like Carmen Electra?
Primarily Carmen Electra, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I had a friend that had a poster of her in his bedroom. And then my other friends would go in just to look at it.
Let's move on before I start saying inappropriate things.
Like Carmen Electra's hot?
Yes.
That's not inappropriate, whatever.
No, it's just
she is hot.
It's just a fact.
Or she was, anyway, I don't know.
Yeah, not so much anymore, but...
Okay, so, like I said, Baywatch is an American action drama series. It's about lifeguards in Los Angeles and then Hawaii.
You are using the words action and drama very loosely there.
Yes, I am. People running. Okay. It was created by Michael Burke, Douglas Schwartz, and Gregory J. Bonin, who all produced it throughout its 11 seasons. It debuted on NBC in 1989 and was canceled after just one season.
Feels like that should have been the end of this story, but...
But the three producers plus David Hasselhoff, the lead actor on the show, revived the show for first-run syndication in 1991, which I didn't really realize was a thing.
Well, it's like what Jeopardy is today. Jeopardy's been first-run syndication for three and a half decades.
But I didn't realize that, like, drama, whatever, is what would be that. I thought it was just game shows.
It's unusual, but sure, it can happen. Basically, any show that, like, doesn't get picked up by a network, they can try to find backing to do this.
Yeah, so anyway, Hasselhoff was also given the title of executive producer for his help with bringing the show back. The show revolves around a team of lifeguards with storylines about beach-related dangers and other aspects of the beach lifestyle.
You couldn't see the air quotes, but you could hear them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they did 11 seasons about that, but apparently they did. I don't know.
Not to mention the spinoff, which I'm sure you're going to talk about, Baywatch Nights.
Yeah.
Which is just...
I don't know. I think
fucking insanity that show existed.
Yes, I did.
That's amazing. All right, we'll get to that. That's incredible.
The show is also known for its revolving door of cast members, kind of like a soap opera. By the end of the show, there wasn't a single cast member left from the beginning.
Yeah, that sounds right.
David Hasselhoff, of course, starred in the most episodes at 220, followed by Jeremy Jackson, Michael Newman, and Pamela Anderson. Hasselhoff played Mitch Buchanan, Jackson played Hobie Buchanan, Mitch's son. Newman, a real lifeguard, played a caricature of himself, which is pretty hilarious, and Anderson played C.J. Parker. Like, they just got a lifeguard and was like, you can figure this out.
I didn't know that. That's weird.
Yep.
It's like that guy who got his start acting when he submitted an audition video to play a drill sergeant, because he was a real drill sergeant, that guy who died. What the hell's his name?
Well, now you have to tell me his name.
I can't think of it. He's a character actor. He got his start playing a drill sergeant. He submitted a video of him just screaming for 15 minutes, and he never repeated an insult. And they were just like, oh my god, this is amazing. You're Googling this right now, I assume. It's that guy, that old dude. You recognize him. You know him. Fuck, what's his name? Yeah, I found him. His name is R. Lee Emery. The R is short for Ronald, but professionally he was known as Ermey. Ermey. So he was a former Marine drill instructor. Right, he played Gunnery Sergeant Hartman in Full Metal Jacket. That's what I'm thinking of. So when he was brought on as, like, a consultant, and he was involved in the casting process for this character, this drill sergeant character, and no one fit what he was looking for, and so he just submitted an audition tape for himself, and it was just him screaming obscenities for 15 minutes, and he never repeated an insult, and they were just like, okay, no one can do this better than you.
He was House's dad, John House.
Oh, he was, wasn't he? God, that's a good show.
Such a good show. Oh, we haven't watched that in so many years.
No, we haven't. Anyway.
Speaking of good shows, about all right, unlikable characters.
Yeah, House is extremely unlikable.
So unlikable.
But he's such a great character.
So
anyway,
lovable.
Continue telling me about this terrible show with probably unlikable characters, I'm going to guess, because we're talking about David Hasselhoff and Pamela Anderson, so hard to imagine them being likable.
Yeah. In 1999, production costs had risen in Los Angeles, and the syndication market was shrinking, so the producers decided to move production. They first decided to go to Australia and even filmed a pilot for Baywatch Down Under, but there was a strong local opposition from the residents of Avalon Beach in New South Wales, and the local government ended up banning future production.
Stand strong, Oz. Good for you.
Yeah. Hawaii then offered them financial incentives to film there, so Baywatch Hawaii was launched. When the setting moved to Hawaii, most of the longtime cast members left the show. Like, they weren't about to move to Hawaii.
No shit.
The only ones to stay were Hasselhoff, Brooke Burns, Michael Bergen, and Michael Newman, the lifeguard.
Brooke Burns? The game show host?
She's not a game show host. Well, she's Brooke Burns. I mean, I guess she is now.
Hosted several mediocre game shows.
Yep. I like her.
She's all right.
Dog Eat Dog.
Dog Eat Dog was the trashiest shit in the world, and I liked it.
We watched so much of that as kids.
Yeah.
Just then, so much.
And then she hosted the first American version of The Chase on Game Show Network, not the current version, which is hosted by some...
Sarah...
Haynes?
Nope. That sounds good. That
she's,
sounds right.
I don't know. She's
feels
some
right.
generic newscaster or something. She's totally nothing.
She's cute. I don't know.
At least Brooke Burns had a personality. She has nothing.
She doesn't have time for a personality.
I suppose not.
Okay. Hasselhoff and Newman left after season 10... The show originally filmed at Will Rogers State Beach on Santa Monica Bay, and then filming moved to Honolulu when they moved to Hawaii. The show led to a spinoff that you mentioned called Baywatch Nights.
This is the fucking wildest thing ever.
Yeah, which was a police slash sci-fi show that aired in syndication from 1995 to 1997.
Starring David Hasselhoff as a former lifeguard turned police investigator slash paranormal investigator.
Because, of course.
Fucking,
and it all-
I mean... How does that get the green light?
I don't know. It also starred Gregory Allen Williams and Angie Harmon, better known for Rizzoli and Isles.
Really?
Yes.
I've obviously never seen this show, because why would I have seen this show, but I didn't... Okay, sure.
Baywatch also had three direct-to-video movies called Baywatch the Movie Forbidden Paradise.
Fuck no.
It gets
that
worse.
Is not real.
It gets worse. Baywatch White Thunder at Glacier Bay.
Well, that's just...
sounds like a porn.
I was going to say it sounds like a white supremacist recruiting video.
Yeah, that too.
Good lord.
And then the last one was Baywatch Hawaiian Wedding. Keeping it simple.
Good God.
Since the show ended, there have been many references to it. David Hasselhoff has frequently satirized his role, such as in the SpongeBob SquarePants movie where he appears in lifeguard attire running across a beach in slow motion.
That's incredible.
And Baywatch running has become a thing unto itself and is often referenced in parodies. The slow motion running.
Right. My favorite... reference is from Futurama when Pamela Anderson's preserved head walks in. So I forget why, but like someone has recreated Fry's pizza parlor where he used to walk, and Pamela Anderson.
Where he used to what?
Where he used to work, excuse me. And Pamela Anderson walks in with her like preserved head in a vat, and she says, it's me, 20th century actress Pamela Anderson, you know, from Baywatch, the movie. And someone says to her, no, that hasn't come out yet. She says, what? I haven't won my Oscar yet? It was the first movie shot entirely in slow motion. God. That's a good joke. Futurama's a good show.
This is the other reference. Is it's prominently featured in the movie Borat, when Borat becomes obsessed with Pamela Anderson.
Oh, so bad.
After seeing her in an episode of the show, which he thinks is a documentary.
Right.
He goes to America to try and court her, and later tries to abduct her.
And she was in on that joke.
Yeah.
I read this once. She was in on the gag, so she knew he was going to, like, put a bag over her head and try to escape with her, but her security detail didn't.
Oh, my God.
So the reaction of these enormous muscled men, like, chasing Sacha Baron Cohen and basically trying to kill him to protect Pamela Anderson, that's real.
I haven't seen that movie since it first came out. I don't really remember it.
I feel like it would not be as funny as we thought it was 10 years ago.
I feel like
but...
we should watch Borat's subsequent movie film because I'm so curious. I'm just curious.
There's
more
no
curiosity.
Way that's good, right?
I don't know. He
don't
won
know.
An award. He got nominated for awards.
But he was nominated for awards in 2020 when no movies came out.
That's fair, but still. I don't know.
I don't know, but I don't know. I just remember reading that and being so fascinated that, like, Sacha Baron Cohen basically risked getting shot by her private security to get this take, and she knew it was happening because they're friends, apparently, but her security detail didn't. That is incredible.
Yeah. Anyway, just to finish up.
Commitment to the craft, Sacha Baron Cohen. I mean, you're a fucking lunatic, but good for you.
Yeah. Anyway, just to finish up, there was a Baywatch movie released in 2017, which starred Dwayne Johnson as Mitch Buchanan, as well as Zac Efron as Matt Brody.
I'm sorry, who as Mitch Buchanan?
The Rock.
The Rock, yes, correct.
It received 5 nominations at the Golden Raspberry Awards, including Worst Picture and Worst Actor for Efron.
Yeah, no fucking shit. I talked about the Razzies a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Bad movie.
Yeah, terrible, I'm sure. There's no way that was going to be good. And like, I like The Rock as an actor. I think of all of the pro wrestlers turned actors, he's probably the best actor.
Dave Bautista's...
Batista's pretty good.
John Cena's pretty good.
John Cena was great in Suicide Squad, I will say that. But I mean,
I feel like Batista's like coming up and coming. Like, I feel like we're going to see some good stuff.
Well, The Rock has the best pedigree of any of them. Like, he's been in the most movies. He has the most experience.
He has his own TV show now. It's quite good. Highly recommend.
That's true. He does. But, I mean, no, there's
you
no way
watch that.
That's going to be
we
good.
We have to watch it.
All right. There's no way that a Baywatch movie is going to be good. I don't care who you put in it.
Terrible idea. All right, last one. Question 6. It's everything else.
All right.
What company's logo features the Tutti Frutti hat worn by Carmen Miranda in the film The Gang's All Here?
Okay. So everything else is going to be the one with the most correct answers this season, because I did not get sports and games correct, but that would be Chiquita.
That is correct.
And are we talking about the horrible, dismal history of the banana trade?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Go for it.
Dark game. Sorry. Baywatch and Lolita.
I was going to say, if you thought Lolita was bad, wait till you hear what the real world has to offer. Because this shit is awful.
My Baywatch joke was funny.
That was funny.
Thank you.
This shit is terrible.
Okay. Chiquita Brands International, SARL, I don't know why that's part of it, is a producer and distributor of produce, particularly bananas. They are the leading distributor of bananas in the United States. The company began in 1870 when Lorenzo Dow Baker, a ship captain, bought 160 bunches of bananas in Jamaica and sold them in Jersey City 11 days later. Okay, I'm done. Felt appropriate.
Knew there was going to be one of those. At least we got it out of the way early.
We did.
All right, continue.
In 1878, Baker partnered with Andrew Preston to form the Boston Fruit Company. Meanwhile, a Central American railroad developer named Minor C. Keith, like imagine naming your kid Minor, started planting bananas in Costa Rica. In 1899, Keith's fruit business and the Boston Fruit Company merged to form United Fruit Company, which became listed on the New York Stock Exchange in 1903. Fruit!
I've had banana republics on my list of things to talk about for a while. I guess I'm going to have to take it off because I assume you're going to cover that.
Pretty much.
Dark chapter in American history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess.
All right.
I don't know. I never used the word banana republic.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll
okay,
see
I'll
where
leave,
it takes us.
I'll leave it on my list.
I stuck to Chiquita, so we'll see what happens.
Well, the United Fruit Company was one of the major offenders, I guess would be the word.
Okay, so United Fruit Company became the first company to use refrigeration for open sea transport, which is interesting. In 1928, United Fruit Company workers in Cienega, Colombia went on strike. The company asked the U.S. government for help repressing the strike.
Yeah, here it comes.
But the Colombian government sent its own military to Cienega, where they killed many of the plantation workers. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And this became known as the Masacre de las Bananeras, or Banana Massacre. Although I like how in Spanish it's like bananeras, like the people that deal with bananas. But we don't have a word for that.
Right, we don't have a term for
banana
person. Yeah.
Bananeras.
Bananera.
I love it.
It's a good word.
It is. It's great. As a side note, this massacre was alluded to in 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Interesting. We should talk about him at some point.
There comes the accent again. It's fine.
Maybe I'll talk about him so you don't do your Spanish accent.
I'm told it's great. My Spanish teacher said that I had no accent, which is high praise.
All right.
In 1944, the company released the advertising single Chiquita Banana, then registered the brand name Chiquita as a trademark in 1947. It's like, you know, I'm Chiquita Banana, and I'm here to say, or whatever it is. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely not. No, what?
Okay, moving on.
Okay. What does Chiquita mean? It means little something. I don't know what, though.
Chiquita.
Like, chica means, so it means like little woman?
Like a little girl.
Little girl, okay.
Chiquita.
So, secret hidden theme, sexualizing young girls.
Stop it. The logo, it's coming up, but like the logo originally was a banana, so no.
Yes, bananas aren't sexual at all.
Shut up. Not related to little girl. Okay, whatever.
In this case.
Enough of this. In 1966, the company spread to Europe, and in 1970, they merged with AMK Corporation to form United Brands Company. In 1980, they were a sponsor for the Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, New York. Then in 1990, they changed their name to Chiquita Brands International. Soon after, they began to see a decline in Honduran operations and started the Banana Wars with Japanese-owned fruit company, I don't know how you say this, Fiefs. Fiefs. F-Y-F-F-E-S.
No idea.
Chiquita was illegally taking and destroying Fiefs' shipments, amounting to $10 million in produce.
Wow.
Fiefs' manager sued Chiquita several times, but it didn't really amount to anything. They're a big company.
Yeah.
In 1998, they opened the world's largest banana processing facility in Costa Rica. In 2002, Chiquita filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in order to restructure the company. In 2004, they sold its processed foods division to Seneca Foods, and in 2005, they purchased Fresh Express salads from Performance Food Group. You've heard of those. Fresh Express.
Yeah.
In 2014, they were supposed to merge with Fiefs, but the Chiquita shareholders voted against it. In 2019, the company's main offices moved from the United States to Switzerland. The company logo, called Miss Chiquita, was created in 1944 by Dick Brown, the man behind the Hagar the Horrible comic strip.
What?
Those are the words that I just said.
Huh.
And it was a banana wearing a fruit hat. But in 1987, it was changed to a woman wearing a fruit hat, and which I told you was Tutti Frutti hat that Carmen Miranda wore
right
in that movie.
Correct.
In 1963, they began placing stickers with the logo on bananas, and they are still placed by hand to this day to avoid bruising the fruit. And I eat one every day. Every single day.
Okay.
I feel a little bad about it now.
Yeah, they've done some real bad shit, but I guess most major corporations probably have at some point, so...
Like, just imagine your job is to place stickers on bananas to no end.
I'd imagine you don't get paid very much for that, but...
It just seems pointless. My banana does not need a sticker on it. It just really doesn't. That is all. End season. No.
And that was Hallie's Banana Opinions, brought to you by Quiz and Hers.
Hallie's Banana Minute. No, it's Hallie's Dental Minute. Bananas are fine for your teeth.
We haven't had Hallie's Dental Minute in a while.
I don't know. It hasn't come up.
No.
I'm ready at any moment.
Okay.
Ask me a question. I'm ready.
All right. I have a feeling we might have Hallie's Dental Minute at the beginning of next season.
I'm excited.
Because I know what my theme is for the
I
premiere
swear to God,
next
if it's
season.
Dentistry, I'll kill you.
It's not dentistry.
Okay, good, because I'm saving that for a special day.
All right. It's not dentistry, but I have a feeling that one or two of the questions might bring...
One or two?
You'll see.
Oh, I can't wait this long.
You'll see. Hey everyone, we will be back to our regularly scheduled episode of Quiz and Hers in just one moment, but first we want to take a moment to recommend another great trivia podcast we think you might enjoy. If you're liking what we're doing here, you should check out the Brain Ladle podcast. That's Brain, L-A-D-L-E, because I can never remember how to spell that kitchen tool. They are just a bunch of guys who quiz each other every week. Every quiz has a theme, sort of like ours, but they do 24 questions and a 10-answer final bonus round at the end. So, a lot more questions and a lot less dicking around than on our show. So,
less talking, more questioning.
Correct, yes. But it's a real fun show, and if you enjoy what we're doing here, definitely go check them out on wherever you get your podcasts. That's Brain Ladle Podcast.
Enjoy.
All right, so that is the end of the season. I won, I think the final score is 19 to 15. I got three, right? No, wait, how many did I get right?
I don't know, who cares?
All right, doesn't matter. I won.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to be a sore loser. You got one, two, three. I think you got four.
I did get four, so 19, yeah, okay.
Oh, I suck. I thought those were hard.
19 to 15. No, 16. 19 to 16 is the final score.
Boo!
Hooray! I am your first ever seven-time Quiz and Hers champion, Justin, saying it is time for Fact or Fucked. So, this last Fact or Fucked of the season comes to us, as they so often do, from our friend Cormac. Here's what he says. All countries use their ISO 3166-1 two-letter country code for their internet top-level domain. For example, .us, .fr, .it, etc. The only exception to this is the United Kingdom, who use .uk instead of .gb, as .uk was founded before standardization. The standardization to .gb was so widely ignored by British developers that .uk was eventually formally assigned to the UK and .gb depreciated.
That was too long and boring. Fact. There's no way he wrote that.
It is fact.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
if it was not fact, he would have written a nice, snappy, real-sounding nonsense.
It's true. Thing. We're on to your tricks
we're
now,
Cormac. Figuring you out.
Yeah, so .gb, of course, would stand for .Great Britain, right? But in the very early days of the internet, when it was just completely the Wild West, apparently the .uk extension gained a lot of steam, which, I mean, that's what it should be, because... The country is not called Great Britain, it's called the United Kingdom, so it's weird that that's even... But whatever. So the attempt was made to make .gb the top-level domain in the UK, but .uk had already caught on, and eventually the people in charge of the internet basically shrugged their shoulders and said, fine, fuck it, .uk it is, or, .uk it is, I guess. So, there you go.
Cool.
I should talk about the history of the internet. I've talked about Tim Berners-Lee and, like, the very early history of the World Wide Web, but this stuff actually really I do find interesting, like, all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes and, like, who kind of runs all of the infrastructure and all. I should talk about that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so thank you, Cormac, as always, for your contribution.
You guys
should all follow him on Twitter at Cormac's Thoughts. He is hilarious and... mostly just tweets about his daily goings-on in humorous ways, but occasionally also tweets trivia stuff. So go follow him at Cormac's Thoughts, and that'll do it, I guess. That's the end of the show.
Yeah.
We gotta find a better way to end this, because we just sort of peter out. But
what do you want to say?
I don't know.
May the trivia gods be with you. I don't know.
Not bad. We'll workshop it over the
may
break.
May you learn each day and... I don't know. I felt like that was going somewhere. I give up.
All right. You know what? I take it back. We don't need a new way to end. All right. We'll see you guys next season. So we're going to be off for a few weeks, but we'll be back. When are we back? Hang on.
In a few weeks.
Middle of October.
Cool.
So, yes, we will see you after our brief off season for season 14. And we'll see if Hallie can tie the season championship record 7-7.
She can.
All right. We'll see.
Okay.
All right. See you guys in a few weeks.
Bye.
Bye.
As a side note, this massacre was alluded to in 100 Years of Solitude.
Just try that again, because that was a train wreck.